When you turn on your faucet at home or flush the toilet, how often do you think about where that water comes from, or how much other people are using, or how much fresh water is available to us? If you're like me, those thoughts rarely ever cross your mind. Actually, most of us take one of the most essential ingredients for our existence for granted. Even though we in Western Wisconsin live in a very water-rich environment, our supply of H2O is not infinite. And each year, there is more demand for it, whether it be from increasing populations, industry, or agriculture. So this hour on the West Side, we'll take the hour to ponder groundwater, where it is, how it gets there, how much we've got in Western Wisconsin, and how our increasing thirst may affect our supply. I'm Rich Kramer, and this is the West Side. For our discussion this evening, we'll learn about the aquifer near to all of us in Western Wisconsin. That is the Mount Simon Aquifer. We'll learn about it with Department of Natural Resources hydrogeologist Larry Lynch, who joins us from our studios in Madison. Larry Lynch, thank you so much for joining us.
You're welcome. Nice to be here.
And then we'll look at two of the industries in Western Wisconsin that use a tremendous amount of water. We'll talk about how much water is used by agriculture with UW Extension crops and soils educator and agriculture expert, in my opinion, Jerry Clark. And Jerry joins us in studio. Jerry, thanks so much for being here.
Thanks for inviting me, Rich.
And we'll also talk about a relatively new industry in Western Wisconsin that also uses a lot of water, that being frac sand mining and processing with Chippewa County. And we'll speak with Chippewa County land conservationist Dan Masterpole, who is also in studio. And Dan, thank you so much for stopping by.
Thanks for the invitation, Rich.
And we want to hear from you, the listener. How much do you work with water? Do you take it for granted like I do? And do you worry that we might be using too much? Give us a call. The number is 800-228-5615. That number, again, is 800-228-5615. If you're a little bashful to go live on air, you can go to our Westside Facebook page and write your comment or question there. Just go in the search function, type in The West Side. And with that, we're going to start with the hydrogeologist expert and water expert, Larry Lynch. Now, when we talk about groundwater in Western Wisconsin, Larry, we're talking about the Mount Simon Aquifer, aren't we?
You're talking about a number of different aquifers. I mean, there are different units within what's referred to as the Cambrian formations. So, I mean, there's the Mount Simon, the Jordan, the Wanawak. They're all different sandstone units within the Cambrian.
Okay. So how big are these? They're pretty large beasts, aren't they?
Well, sure. I mean, the Cambrian sandstone, I'll speak of it as one unit. I mean, it covers, many counties. I mean, it's the first bedrock throughout many counties in the state. And, again, it'll vary in thickness. Sometimes it may only be tens of feet thick. Other times the various formations may be several hundred feet thick.
Hmm, okay.
So it's a fairly extensive aquifer system, and it's widely used from Madison, all the way, up to your part of the state, Barron County, Washburn County.
Mm-hmm. And when some of the laymans like myself think about groundwater, they imagine some kind of an underground lake. How accurate a description is that?
Well, it's not real accurate. It's, it's more akin to, if you were to take a swimming pool or, some unit or some vessel and fill it with sand and crushed rock and different units and then fill that with water. The rock occurs within the pore spaces within that geologic material, be it sandstone or sand and gravel, maybe a tight limestone where the water is only occurring in fractures, basically.
Okay.
The same thing with some of the Precambrian rock up in the extreme part of northwest Wisconsin, where It's usually a really tight rock that doesn't hold water, but if it's fractured, it is possible to get a well out of that type of material.
All right. So fracking, that's the same kind of fracking that we see in oil and natural gas?
No, I'm talking about natural fractures in the rock.
Oh, okay, because I thought I had heard that you can frack a water well.
You can.
Okay.
You can. But what I'm talking about in the sense of an aquifer is the porosity of a unit of rock, whether it's sandstone or limestone or granite or some other rock.
Okay.
Again, in sandstone, the water occurs between the grains of sand. In limestone, most of the water occurs in fracture systems or along bedding planes. And in crystalline bedrock, it occurs, again, primarily in fractures that happen to be there when after the rock is in place through different different processes. You do get fractures occurring in the rocks.
So have we as a state or regional counties or whatever, do we have a pretty good handle on what's going on, how much what movement there is in these aquifers? Or
I think overall, yes. I mean, our state geological survey, along with the U.S. Geological Survey and other researchers that through the UW system and other schools, have done a fair amount of work throughout the state to try to quantify and characterize our groundwater resources. Again, up in your part of the state, I'm aware of several studies that have been done, kind of multiple county studies, you know, modeling the groundwater system and trying to get a better understanding of what's there, how much, what its quality is, and the department is trying to gather data on how much water is being used. We've been tracking water use from high-capacity wells since 2006. We did it historically, but it stopped for about 15 years.
Mm-hmm.
But since 2006, we've been collecting annual pumpage data from high-capacity wells throughout the state. And that information will be useful as we try to manage groundwater resources in areas where we may have pumping stresses and overuse of groundwater.
Right. And so just a ballpark figure, how many in western Wisconsin, I'm talking about the counties from St. Croix over to Chippewa County and from as far north as Spooner down to Trampolo County. Any idea, ballpark, how many high-capacity wells we're talking about? Because I saw on the DNR website, I found that what I think told me that there's 239 or so in Chippewa County itself.
That's right. 239 in Chippewa, about 400 in Dunn, about 200 in Eau Claire, 400 and some in Barron. And those are the counties that have the most up in that part of the state.
Okay.
I mean, I checked the records before I came over, and, I mean, those were the four that I checked.
Very good, very good.
And, I mean, one thing to keep in mind, though, is not everything that's a high-capacity well, by definition, is pumping a lot of groundwater.
Okay.
But, I mean, that's kind of a nuance of high-capacity wells and how they're regulated.
So some of the wells might be sitting idle then or just pumping very little?
Again, a high-capacity well is any well on a given property where the combined pumping capacity on that property is 70 gallons a minute or more.
Okay.
So if you have a farm property with an irrigation well that may pump 1,000 gallons a minute and they happen to have a house, the well that serves the house is regulated as a high-capacity well.
Oh, okay. Understood.
Also. So again, I mean, you get a sense of the numbers, so... Again, Barron and Dunn counties, you know, have the most high-capacity wells up in that part of the state. And we've been seeing more in those two counties. I know over the last 4 or 5 years, they've been probably the two most prolific in that part of the state.
Right, and we'll get to that. I mean, part of that is definitely the frac sand, the industry, but also farming, isn't it?
Yep. In Dunn County particularly, the increase is primarily related to irrigation wells.
Okay. Now... something I read when I was doing some research for this program, and it's just fascinating to me that I read that some water in the Mount Simon Aquifer has been there for 30,000 years. How can we possibly know that, Larry Lynch?
Well, I suspect they put that number on it. You can do different age dating processes, you know, kind of like carbon dating on materials where they determine how old. You know, whatever, piece of rock or piece of wood or whatever it is. You can do other similar types of tests to age groundwater.
Okay, so does that mean that the water moves through this formation or these formations in our region anyway, in western Wisconsin, very slowly, or is it different from area to area?
Well, it'll differ from area to area and also differ from formation to formation.
Okay. So...
There could be areas where, you know, water in the deeper parts of the aquifer where water is getting close to being stagnant and not moving at all.
Okay.
But you can have other parts of the aquifer where there's higher gradient, meaning, you know, higher slope to the aquifer and different pressures that cause the water to move more rapidly.
All right. All right, very good. Now, we've got our first caller on the line, and a reminder to all the other listeners out there that you can call in at 800-228-5615 if you've got a question or comment about our groundwater and the different things that might be affecting it, like agriculture, increasing population, and other industries like frac sand mining. And this question is going to Augusta, and we've got Carrie on the line. And Carrie, thanks for calling in. What's on your mind? I'm sorry. I just potted you up. So what's on your mind, Carrie?
I live on a farm in Augusta, and we don't use a well water for farming, but we have been introduced now to sand mining, mm-hmm. which is coming to our area. And so one of the questions that we've had at a lot of the hearings has to do with these wells that they'll put in for the frac sand mining, and we're really curious how it really will affect our well water. We've been told they go to a water table below our water table, something to that effect, that it won't affect our wells, but we're very dubious that it could impact us.
All right. I'll put that one to both. First I'll go to Dan Masterpole. He's quite involved with this process of permitting frac sand companies, and he knows a lot about it. So what about that? What goes into when a frac sand mining company tries to get a permit for a well or for an operation?
First of all, any new frac sand mine needs to get local permits, non-metallic mine reclamation permits at a minimum. If they're going to be doing any type of wash plant processes, they also need to get a high cap well permit through the Department of Natural Resources. We've had the experience with a number of mines in Chippewa County that have been planned and permitted with wash plant processes similar to the one you're talking about, I think. What we've learned is that the mining companies are needing to secure high volumes of water to wash the sand. And to assure that they get adequate water supplies, they're drilling their wells very deep into this Mount Simon aquifer. And
how deep are we talking?
Generally, I think in the neighborhood of 150 to 200 feet in Chippewa County to get well below the local bedrock layers that may have water in them but are not they don't provide enough yield to assure that they get the supply that they need. So they'll drill their wells through these overlying bedrock layers, generally what's left of the Waniwak layer and the Eau Claire layer, which serves as kind of a barrier. And they'll case their well by putting a metal sleeve all the way through that Eau Claire aquifer, and then draw from that deep Mount Simon aquifer. And some of the companies have actually installed deep and shallow groundwater monitoring wells that they use to determine what impacts they're having on that surface water aquifer and the deep aquifer. And what we're seeing is from those well tests is that when they turn their production wells on, the groundwater in the deep Mount Simon aquifer draws down very close to the well, but its cone of depression, the area of effect,
right,
is relatively limited. For example, within maybe several hundred yards.
So when you talk about a cone of depression, this is a term that we're definitely going to hear more during the show. And whenever you start to talk about groundwater, what is a cone of depression Dan Master Paul?
Well, I'll probably ask Larry to
help me
out here. But if I recall, it is the area of influence from the pumping of the well.
Mm-hmm.
And the cone of depression will be most pronounced if the yield that can be gained from the aquifer is limited. So if you've got a poor aquifer, the cone of depression will extend further out and affect greater areas. But if it's a rich aquifer, the cone of depression is it's a very sharp cone,
mm-hmm.
and the lateral effect on the other wells is more limited. So what we're finding through these pump tests is that the aquifer is rich enough that as soon as they turn off, first of all, it's not a significant cone of depression,
mm-hmm.
and as soon as they turn off the pumping well, it bounces back very quickly.
Within minutes, hours, or?
Yes, within tens of minutes.
Wow.
And the monitoring wells on the surface are showing no impacts on the upper aquifers. So these are the kind of case studies that can be done to evaluate the potential impacts on surrounding residents. I don't want to discount that there could be impacts because we need to look at the cumulative impacts of many wells in the area. But the science exists for these companies, I think, the caller's name was Carol.
Carrie, yeah.
Carol. To provide you some levels of assurance as to what those impacts might be.
All right.
Can I add?
Absolutely.
A couple of things. I mean, another thing that will determine whether or not nearby wells are affected is how those wells are constructed themselves. For the most part, when residential wells are installed, the well drillers will go just deep enough to get enough water. So they're not typically going, you know, through a good aquifer material into a deeper one.
Sure.
And so that helps in the sense that, you know, Dan was talking about going through overlying units. And an important one that he mentioned is the Eau Claire. And the Eau Claire typically is a shaley material that doesn't transmit much water. And as Dan said, it serves as an aquitard so that if you pump from a lower unit, you don't see the effect in the upper units. So if nearby wells are finished in the upper sandstone units and they're pumping from the lower one and the Eau Claire is there and it's effective, you shouldn't see impacts in the upper unit.
Okay, very interesting.
And the other significant thing for pumping tests, the other thing we use them for, is also to assess impacts to surface waters. So if we have concerns with wetlands or lakes or streams in the area, a pumping test will help us, gather the information we need to assess whether or not pumping of that well could cause impacts to surface waters as well.
Right, and we're going to, a little later in the program, we'll talk with Dan about a study that's going on right now that's being spearheaded by Chippewa County working with Trout Unlimited and with some frac sand mining companies, I believe, to kind of gauge whether or not there would be an impact on surface waters. But here's a theoretical question for you, Larry Lynch. Could we ever drink these aquifers, the Mount Simon or the other Cambrian, could we ever just deplete them entirely? Or is that a dumb question?
I won't say it's dumb, but, it would take a lot to do it.
Okay.
I think a more likely scenario is you may get areas within the Mount Simon where if you have a really concentrated development or concentrated industrial activity, where within that local zone you could have issues with water.
All right. We'll go back to the phones right now, and we're going to get to agriculture in just a bit, and we'll be taking a break soon. But before we do that, we'll go to Wilson, and we've got Mike on the line. Mike, thanks for calling in. What's your question?
Well, I hear this talk about the aquifer, and the question I have is this water something that would be replaced in the short term by normal percolation through the ground, or is this water that's fossil water, basically been down there for thousands of years, and it's really not likely to be replaced in any kind of a reasonable time frame.
Good question, and I'll put that one to Larry Lynch.
Yeah. It is water that gets replaced, but in many cases, because these aquifers are very deep, the areas where the water gets put back into the aquifer could be tens to hundreds of miles away. So you have what's called a recharge area. And so for any given location, you can kind of calculate or determine where the recharge area is for that particular spot. And again, when you have a deep aquifer, it could be, like I said, tens to hundreds of miles away.
Okay, so a gentle slope kind of a situation there, maybe?
Yeah.
Okay, I got you.
And it takes a long time for the water to percolate, to that depth of 250 feet through other aquifer systems. And especially if you have a confined aquifer like the Mount Simon is in many cases with the Eau Claire, that's more likely that the recharge area is further away.
All right. I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Well, I was going to say that's in contrast to, sand and gravel aquifers where the recharge area is local.
All right.
Rainwater percolates directly into the sand and gravel aquifers.
We're talking about groundwater in western Wisconsin and whether we're putting too much strain or if it's possible to put too much strain on our aquifers. We are joined by agriculture expert Jerry Clark, who we'll hear from in just a bit when we return from the break. We're also joined by hydrogeologist with the DNR, Larry Lynch, and Chippewa County conservationist Dan Masterpole. If you've missed part of the program or would like to listen to years' worth of West Sides, check out our online archives. You can go to WPR.org, click on the West Side link, and then click on the Listen Here link. We'll be back with more discussion about agriculture as it relates to groundwater on the West Side in just a bit. I'm Rich Kramer, and you're listening to West Side. And we're talking about groundwater on the West Side. I'm Rich Kramer, and you're listening to the West Side on Wisconsin Public Radio. Thanks for joining us. Groundwater is one of those things that we cannot live without, but yet many of us do take it for granted. We've got an abundant supply right here in our region, but it's not infinite, and every year there is more demand for our groundwater in western Wisconsin. We're talking about it this hour with hydrogeologist Larry Lynch of the DNR, UW Extension Crops and Soils Educator Jerry Clark, and Chippewa County Land Conservationist Dan Masterpole. If you've got a question or a comment about groundwater and the different draws on it, give us a call at 800-228-5615. We'd love to get you into the conversation. Or you can also go to our Westside Facebook page and post your comment or question there. And with that, I'd like to talk about agriculture, because agriculture, as we all can assume, uses plenty of water. And Jerry Clark, when we drive through the countryside, we all see those giant sprinklers used on farm fields.
Sure.
Are each one of those connected to a high-capacity well, and how much water do those puppies pump out?
Yeah, for the most part, those it depends on the irrigation system, but if it's a center pivot where we see a long stream of sprinklers together that revolve around a center point, typically those are all going to be connected to a high-capacity well. For the most part, they're going to draw between 800 to 1,000 gallons a minute, depending on the type of system. There are still some traveling guns, individual systems out there, as well as maybe a few older permitted systems that might be drawing from a stream or a nearby river yet. But typically most are being permitted as a high-capacity well. But typically you're looking at, 800 to 1,000 gallons a minute through those.
And those are going down into the deep aquifers that you know of?
Yeah, very similar to the sand mining permits, where you're going to be drawing, you need a high yield to pull that much water per minute out. So, yeah, they're typically going, I'm just speaking from the Chippewa County perspective, 100 to 150 feet deep. And a lot of local wells maybe are 40 to 60 feet deep. So they go well below that into a deeper setting anyway.
Now, in a previous conversation that you and I had, you mentioned that there's a formula, a rough ballpark estimate for how much water it takes to water an acre of crops. What was that?
Yeah, well, typically if you get an inch of water over an acre is about 27,000 gallons, roughly.
Okay.
So from that we can kind of get an estimate of how much water is being used if an irrigation system is to put on an inch of water at a time. Typically, these systems are usually run to put on about a half to a three-quarter inch amount of rain at any one setting or one run that they run through their fields. So in some cases, you'll see these pivots. A common is a quarter-mile system, which takes in about 160 acres. So it doesn't hit all 160 acres, as, of course, you've got a circle going into a square field, for example. You're going to have some misses on the corners. But it may take, if we're looking at 27,000 gallons at 1,000 gallons a minute, we're maybe looking over that 160 acres, you're talking about 4.3 million acres, and which would take about 3 days for it to run that type of system.
Wow.
So quite a bit of water just being used for maybe putting on 1 inch, which would be that 27,000 gallons per acre.
Well, this is nothing new. We've been doing this for centuries in Wisconsin.
Yeah, I think we really saw irrigation early, late 60s, early 70s, and then as we got dry again in the mid 70s, and 1988 was another widespread drought, more farmers putting those systems in. And just recently we were, northwestern Wisconsin, right here, mm-hmm. we had 2005 through 2008 being well below precipitation. So we saw farmers starting to update systems, putting in maybe a lower pressure system. So they're trying to manage that. Even from an energy standpoint, they don't need quite as much pressure to run a low-pressure system as they would with an older system that had the sprinklers on top. Now they have more of a drop tube where the sprinklers on the bottom hangs lower in the system, so they don't need quite as much pressure.
Okay.
So we saw modifications being done to older systems, but newer systems being put in simply because we're starting to see corn prices, as long as revenue is there. For these farms, they are starting to see that irrigation as insurance, and maybe also so they can guarantee themselves a crop, kind of take the drought risk out of it a little bit, but also seeing a better yield. Maybe if they can manage their fertilizer and their water, they can cut back on some fertilization or possibly increasing water in order to make up for a better yield.
And since corn prices have been so high, we have seen – I remember we did a show before where mm-hmm. – there has been a tremendous amount of farmers switching crops to corn, planting corn like crazy. Mm-hmm. Is corn, is any one crop, like example for being corn, thirstier than others? I mean, does it take more water to?
Yeah, typically corn is a big user. Our biggest user is actually alfalfa.
Oh.
So if we look at it from what can hold the water in the system better, it'd be alfalfa. So as we switch from alfalfa to more of a corn-based, corn and soybean grain. We're seeing that transition from dairy farms into more grain and soybean production. We could be seeing a little more water use just because that crop's more marketable. As we grew more alfalfa in the past, that is actually the crop that would demand it more. But for instance, corn, when we get into where the cob is starting to set grain filling part of the year, we're looking at using a third of an inch of water a day.
Wow.
So every 3 days we need an inch of rain, and if we're not going to get it from Mother Nature, farmers are going to turn those irrigation systems on to make sure they get it.
And here's a thought I just had: when these crops, when they're the corn is harvested, it goes away. That's some of that is some water from our region going away, isn't it? In form of corn.
Yeah, I guess you could look at it from that standpoint. Corn is about 13 to 15% moisture when it's sold, so there's a little moisture in there.
Okay.
I think in some cases we look at it, we're more concerned maybe from the fertility standpoint as we're starting to move nutrients around. But yeah, you could look at it that it's low percentage, but as that corn is dried in the fall, it's usually dried out through dryers, so we're seeing that evaporation of the grain as well. But for the most part, I don't think we're moving a lot of water off in terms of harvest, but there's definitely a percentage there.
Now I'd like to go back to Larry Lynch, and you can chime in if you want, Jerry Clark. But since we're seeing more farmers switching to these crops, and you mentioned that there's a lot of farming, a lot of high-capacity wells and farms in parts of western Wisconsin, is that a risk to at least regional to other wells in the area, or are we taking too much water out for agriculture, Larry Lynch?
Well, again, we look at every high capacity well, regardless of what the intended use is, and when we evaluate a high capacity well, we look at whether or not, or we're trying to determine whether or not that well would cause significant impacts to waters of the state. And waters of the state actually are defined as surface water, groundwater, and it includes wetlands, streams, lakes, and it also includes public and private wells. So when we look at a high-capacity well application, we do an evaluation of possible impacts to all of those things. We do encounter some where we think there could be an impact, and when that happens, we place limitations on how much water can be pumped. We may place conditions on how the well can be constructed or should be constructed. We place limits on times of year, for instance, that the well may be used. Again, all intended to try to minimize or reduce any impacts on other waters of the state.
All right, and then Jerry Clark, these wells, these high-capacity wells that are used by farms, they're only running part of the year, which is a little different than the sand mining situation.
Right, from the standpoint of the irrigation, yeah, they're only going to be seasonal, and we can get recharge, you know, through rainfall and snowmelt. But the other part of this, you know, we're in dairy country yet,
right?
And dairy uses a lot of water. Just for example, one dairy cow, a mature dairy milking cow, will consume 30 to 40 gallons a day, and on a hot day, 50 or more.
Wow.
So recently we just got statistics that Chippewa County has 30,000 cows yet, dairy cows. This isn't the young livestock. So we're talking 1.5 million gallons on a hot day.
I'm glad you figured that out.
Yeah, if you're taking the 50 gallons a day times 30,000 cows, that's 1.5 million every day just for the dairy cows. So we still have the young stock. We have turkeys, chickens, calves, sheep. So you still have a great demand just from the dairy industry. Now, this doesn't even include – this is what the cow's drinking. You still have a manure system that needs to be flushed if you have a flush system.
Mm-hmm.
Rinse water, all these systems have to be sanitized. So new systems that farmers are putting in are very efficient. They're reusing as much water as they can. If it's rinsed, if water is used to sanitize the milking system, it's going to be flushed or used to flush maybe the manure system or throughout the livestock building to clean that. So there's a number of different engineering systems that are out there to help reuse as much water as possible. But that's still the cow is still going to drink what she needs every day.
Right.
And in Chippewa County, we're still using about 1.5 million gallons just for the dairy herd.
That is amazing. And that is year-round.
That would be year-round.
Yeah.
Right.
It's just mind-boggling to think about that. So and farmers are doing they're trying to be more efficient with the water, and they're not just doing it to be good, not just doing it to be environmental, you know, minded people. They're doing it to save money, I imagine.
Right? Yeah. There's the more you can reuse, less electricity to use these high capacity wells or the mm-hmm. pumps to get it to the cattle. We're also helping trying to train, especially from the irrigation side, when farmers should turn these systems on, getting to use tensiometers, which is a soil moisture measuring instrument. There's also newer technology you can hook to smartphones that tell you when the soil is dry enough that you can turn your system on. So we're trying to educate owners of center pivots and irrigation systems when's the best time to turn these systems on.
All right. Now, what about pollution of the groundwater system? I mean, that's just as much of a worry, I guess, than overuse. And I'm not sure who to ask the question to, but I'll start with you, Jerry Clark. Mm-hmm. Manure spreading and manure runoff and nutrient nutrients getting into sure. water supplies is a huge issue. Mm-hmm. What is being done to keep these groundwater aquifers pure?
Yeah, well, from the agriculture standpoint, especially if there's livestock involved, most counties through their extension offices or even land conservation departments are offering some type of nutrient management planning, mm-hmm. where we look at what crops are going to be grown, the yields that they're shooting for. And we're measuring through soil testing, finding out what the baseline of this of the nutrients in the soil. So we can balance what manure is being applied with how much that crop's going to remove. And also when they apply it, with nitrogen and sandy soils, especially – sandy soils and irrigation kind of go hand in hand. So if you have a pivot out there, when's the best time to put the nitrogen on? What's the best rate or ahead of a rainfall so we don't leach it into the groundwater and have nitrate contamination issues or high nitrate wells for residents. And then the other issue would be pesticides, working with farmers to develop IPM plans, which integrated pest management plan, to use their pesticides to the best when they're needed instead of just using them because we want to protect the crop. We want to make sure there's maybe a pest present before we use the pesticides. So in the past, atrazine's been one, being discovered maybe in groundwater. So that's a more regulated herbicide that we're currently, when farmers go through pesticide applicator training, we're spending time on how to handle atrazine if they're going
to
use it.
All right. Back to the phone lines. We go to Colfax, and we've got Willem on the line. Willem, thanks for calling in. What's your question?
Well, I had a question about high-capacity wells, and I thought I understood that the DNR regulates and permits individual high-capacity wells, but they don't take into consideration or can't legally or whatever consider the cumulative effect of the number of high-capacity wells into a region. And I was and then I had another question too that pertained to this spreading of liquid manure, which where I live, my well is starting to have a higher nitrate levels, and they've spread it on the fields when the ground is frozen. And a few years ago, when it rained in January, the ditches were running like root beer, you know. So, and that was all going into 18 Mile Creek and then into the Red Cedar River. So, I wonder what could be done about that. I know that they've said they were lifting load limits on roads in the spring so that farmers could haul manure earlier in the spring. But I guess I'm concerned about the ground being frozen and then we're getting a winter rain or something and then all this stuff running off into the ditches.
All right. And we'll start with the cumulative high-capacity well question. I think that's one for Larry Lynch.
Yes, it is. I mean, you're correct. What we do when we get an application in is evaluate the impacts of the proposed well along with any other well on that property. So if there are no other wells on that particular property, we only look at the impacts of a single well. If there are 10 other wells on that property, then we'll evaluate the impacts of the 11 wells combined. And it really does come down to a legal interpretation. And right now, we don't think we have the authority to consider the impacts cumulatively in an area. And the reason for that really goes back to or is founded in basic groundwater law in Wisconsin. And we have a system of reasonable use is what it's termed, which means that any property owner essentially has a right to drill a well and withdraw water from beneath his property as long as it's put to a reasonable use and it doesn't cause significant impacts to his neighbors or significant and direct impacts to surface waters. So if we operate under that approach, what it means is that a landowner can apply for a well and we have to consider his request that even if his neighbors are causing impacts, we have to simply look at that particular well. I will say that it's under litigation right now and it's related to a large dairy operation in the central part of the state, which, again, we've had some issues with, and that's a particular point of litigation as to whether or not we have that authority. And the implication of it is if we get an application in, again, under reasonable use, that person can apply, and if we say that there's already impacts occurring and deny that application, then that's running counter to the reasonable use doctrine. The alternative is, and this is where we don't think we have authority, is that if we believe there are impacts occurring, in order to allow this new well, it means we have to reduce the pumping on existing wells. And that's specifically where we don't think we have the authority to do it. But it is a piece of litigation, or it is in litigation, and it is an issue that we acknowledge that is a weakness or a gap in the laws that currently exists. The legislature made some efforts 2 or 3 years ago to address it, and were unsuccessful. So my guess is in the future we will have clear legislative direction on that issue.
All right. And as to the runoff during a winter rain, Jerry Clark, is that just something that we have to deal with, or is there?
Well, with nutrient management planning, there is some state regulation regarding frozen and snow, applying manure to frozen and snow-covered soils. Some local ordinances have even been adopted by certain counties where there's no spreading in February and March, our highest runoff months. So there are some specific regulations that are already in place. For instance, slopes up to 6 to 9%, but that field has to be contoured if you're going to go apply it on an even steeper slope. Mm-hmm. So it kind of forces farmers to at least put it on more level land. That doesn't mean there isn't going to be a runoff issue, but it's at least something that's helping regulate that. And plus, you can't spread within 300 feet of a surface or a stream or a river or 1,000 feet of a lake. So those are the kind of parameters that farmers are supposed to be taking into account with a nutrient management plan.
All right, Willen, thanks for the call. And other people want to get a call in, it's 800-228-5615. That number again, 800-228-5615. We'll take a quick break. When we come back, we'll talk about frac sand mining and the how much water that industry uses. And it is, of course, a growing industry in our region that gets a lot of attention at this point. You're listening to The West Side on Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Rich Kramer, and you're listening to The West Side on Wisconsin Public Radio. Thanks for joining us. We're talking about groundwater and the different stressors that we as human beings put on it, whether it be agriculture, just plain old population increases, or even industries like frac sand mining, which is growing in our region at this very moment. We are joined by Larry Lynch, a hydrogeologist with the Department of Natural Resources, Jerry Clark, a crops and soils educator with the UW Extension in Chippewa and Eau Claire counties, and Dan Masterpole, a county conservationist for Chippewa County. And with that, go to Dan Masterpole. He's been sitting patiently during the program here. In the last 3 years or so, we've seen a real surge in frac sand mining processing operations. Mining and processing, that is, in western Wisconsin, a lot of them in Chippewa County. Your office deals with those companies every day. How many of these operations are there right now, Dan Masterpole?
Well, in Chippewa County, I think we've permitted nine industrial sand mines in the last 3 years. I've got a couple more that are in the process. Of equal significance, I think we're seeing the same kind of rate of mine permits in Barron and mm-hmm. Eau Claire and surrounding counties. DNR is tracking this now, and I think the number of mines that are being proposed with processing plants is in the neighborhood of 60 or so.
That's what I've seen.
So this is a new industry that is going to be with us for the foreseeable future.
Mm-hmm.
And through the public hearing processes, we did receive a lot of comments from the public regarding the groundwater issue as to what the impacts of this new industry will have on not only existing water supplies, but also water supplies used for supporting manufacturing and agriculture.
Right.
One of the things that has come out of this is a proposal to do kind of a localized groundwater study. We have an area outside of Bloomer and New Auburn where we have four different mines with high-cap wells and processing plants. And there was an interest by those mining companies to kind of join a coalition of the willing and participate in a groundwater study to try to document what the cumulative effects of their mines will be on the surface waters, since these are all adjacent headwater streams, and also on the groundwater system itself. So all of these companies have agreed to put in groundwater monitoring wells around their mines and to collect information that will be used to characterize the geologic and hydrologic conditions in the area and contribute toward a groundwater model that will be put together by the USGS and State Geologic and Natural History Survey to try to evaluate the impacts on water resources and also, most importantly, to evaluate alternative management scenarios that could be used to limit the impacts and to try to conserve water. And this is not just being framed as a study of these mines, but we'll also be taking a look at irrigated agriculture in the area
mm-hmm.
Because it's important to understand that We're working with kind of a system of the commons. As Larry noted, there's a doctrine in Wisconsin that everyone should be able to use as much groundwater as they need. But in fact, we're approaching a time when we need to not only know what people are using and encourage them to use best management practice to conserve the water, but we may be approaching a time where we're looking at moving into an allocation-based system, similar to what happens out in out west where there are limited supplies of water. But before we do something like that, we want to make sure that it's warranted. For comparative purposes, we've thrown a lot of numbers around, but just doing some real rough off the back of the book mark calculations, you know, a 160-acre irrigation system uses about 80 million gallons a year. One of these mines with a wash plant uses somewhere between 100 and 200 million gallons a year. And like the village of New Auburn for its water supply uses 131 million. So if you were to be thinking in terms of high cap wells, one center pivot irrigation system would be pretty much equal to about one mine, which would be equal to about one village domestic water supply. So I really credit the public for being very astute in their observations and their concerns as expressed through the public hearing process, because as you noted, groundwater is not infinite and everything is connected. We use our groundwater supplies, first of all, for our domestic drinking water. Everyone drinks water, and in west central Wisconsin, all of that water is coming from the ground. It's either coming from the shallow aquifers or the deep aquifers. It's also very important to existing manufacturing and irrigation. So the mining industry, as coming in to the system late, wants to provide some assurances to the public to determine whether or not they're having these impacts, and if they are, how they can sustain their systems over the next couple decades, at a minimum probably, to assure that they're not causing undue impacts. I think ultimately it's very important to understand that the biggest driver of groundwater volumes is the amount of precipitation we get. If we're into drought cycles, we should all be concerned, because that's going to affect our surface waters and the amount of groundwater that's in the pool. But I think it's good that we are starting to talk about groundwater as a limited resource, and I think it's important for all of us to understand how important it is.
Now, the each one of those plants uses the same. The plants do tend to be congregated, like you mentioned in New Auburn, or there's even in the I believe it's the northwest corner of Chippewa County where there's a lot, and then the just on the other side of the border, you've got all these companies, and they can use like a million gallons per day, is what I've found. Is that a concern for neighbors in the area, or for just the resources in general?
I think it is a concern. I think I don't know if it's a significant concern, but groundwater is a limited resource, and we need to pay attention to it. I doubt if it's going to affect anyone's domestic water supply, but if these wells are concentrated in high enough concentrations, it's feasible that in combination they could affect surface waters. And I think we're somewhere between don't worry, be happy, and trust and verify. And it's an important enough resource where we need to be conservative enough to not only inventory but to study it. And I commend the DNR for their efforts and the mining industry and agricultural industry for understanding the importance of this and statewide paying it the attention that it deserves.
And we were talking about efficiencies that farmers use to save water, and we are getting very close to the top of the hour. But Dan Masterpole, I've heard that these sand mine operations and processing plants, they do try to recycle as much water as they can.
Well, absolutely, because water is just another form of energy. It costs money to pump water, and it costs a lot of money to use it. And they're implementing these wash plant processes, they're fine-tuning them to try to conserve water and limit the amount of water they're using. But there is a specific volume that they're going to need to process the sand, and they'll hit efficiencies, but after that, it'll be a consumptive use.
Absolutely. All right. Well, with that, I wish we had more time. I always wish we had more time. I'd like to thank my guests for being with us this hour, UW Extension Crops and Soils Educator Jerry Clark, DNR Hydrogeologist Larry Lynch, and Chippewa County Land Conservationist Dan Masterpole. Thank you all for your time and your discussion. I'd also like to thank Team Westside, including Mort Cypress, who handled on-air production, Henry Lippold, who produced tonight's program, Joey Dietrich for promotions, and Ellen Zamaripa and Dean Collenbeck for keeping us all on track. Next Thursday, we'll bring in the Outdoor Guys for a talk about all things outdoors, including their proposed rules and regs for a Wisconsin wolf hunt. Until then, I'm Rich Kramer. Thanks for listening, and we'll chat again next week.